You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 28th of April to the 4th of May 2016. My name is John Elms. I am joined today by books editor Karen Shook, deputy news editor John Morgan, and reporter David Matthews. And in this week's news, Germany's multi-billion euro drive to stamp itself on global university rankings somewhat clashes with its egalitarian history. However, the initiative is throwing into doubt the assumption that the tools for excellence are selectivity and tuition fees. John has been on a trip to Berlin and Munich to see whether tensions can be resolved, and will take us through his discoveries in just a moment. What do students need to improve in their education? A broad stroke question, I grant you, but David has been investigating the concept of character education and how it might be a useful device in students' development. And finally, of course, Karen will be giving us a comprehensive roundup of this week's book section. But first, John, you visited Germany recently to get a feet on the ground sense of what's happening in their HE sector. What's going on?
So the two big themes in Germany at the moment, and the two big things that I looked at, are the Excellence Initiative, which is a programme to sort of get German universities into the world's research elite, and also Germany's recent abolition of tuition fees. The last of the German states to end fees did so in 2014. So features basically looking at the question of whether the Excellence Initiative, with its emphasis on selectivity and improving global standard, whether that's in tension with the more egalitarian traditions of German universities, whereby each institution is treated equally and equally funded, and those traditions are indeed exemplified in the lack of tuition fees in Germany. Mm. So you could look at that two ways. You could say, well, the Excellence Initiative is going to accentuate, you know, the drive to global excellence, and universities are going to want fees even more as they try to step up their competition with counterparts in the US and UK. Or you could say the Excellence Initiative may well raise Germany's egalitarian model to sort of greater international prominence and show that you don't need fees to be excellent. All pretty much the university presidents that I spoke to, the president of Humboldt University in Berlin and the president of the German Rectors Conference, they were extremely pro-fee and thought that this was needed to address what they see as underfunding of German universities and help them compete internationally, saying that the priority for education funding should be in schools and lower down. Sort of earlier on in the educational chain to help the poorest, the kind of arguments we've heard in England as well. But it was interesting that when I spoke to the State Secretary in the Federal Ministry of Education and Research, she was Cornelia Kennett-Thielen, she was his equivalent of a UK Permanent Secretary. She was very sort of fairly blasé about university presidents calling for higher fees, as if that's pretty much what you'd expect. And pointed out that actually in Germany they've increased their funding for higher education. Even in the financial crisis, they've seen it as an investment for the future, as a societal benefit as well as a benefit for individuals. So she was arguing that it's not right to say that Germany's universities are underfunded to international counterparts, given the lack of fees. That's not the case in her eyes, and it was interesting to hear that argument coming from someone who's in a ministry that's controlled by the centre-right CDU party. So politics are very different there.
Quite, and I mean these, as you said, as you mentioned in your piece, and I mentioned earlier, these are quite difficult tensions. I mean, what did you get a sense of one of the two parties having a stronger case for their beliefs, or is it a balanced one, as in most cases?
I think the polarisation of the debate is still there. The positions are still dug in, pro and anti fees, but it's perhaps interesting that regardless of political background, everyone I spoke to thought the fees debate would come back. That it will come back on the agenda this pressure from universities and from some political quarters to introduce fees, and that was the case even from the representative of the FZS Students Union, who said who argued that it will be revived, the fees debate will be revived, because there's still a lot of neoliberals and conservatives left who don't want to pay for the social welfare state with taxation, and who want a society in which individuals pay for themselves, whereas the university's presidents would put it in a different way, of course.
Yeah, it's a really interesting feature, and it kind of raises the whole question of, you know, what is a university system actually for? I just wonder why does Germany even want universities that are kind of high up in the rankings, because it's got these Fraunhofer institutes and so on and it seems to have commercialized lots of research, got strong links between research institutions and university and companies, got loads of high level manufacturing, low unemployment. I mean, what do they see in the kind of US and UK university systems and economies that you think we'd like some of that? I mean, I suppose you've got, you know, Silicon Valley, I suppose, that has grown out of universities in the Bay Area.
Made possible by public funding.
Well,
Mary Ann Mercer-Caddo points out.
I mean, it's, yeah.
Well, right. Certainly the federal government representative that I spoke to from the Ministry of Education said the Excellence Initiative isn't about improving ranking standing, it's about improving the quality of research and, you know, Germany's international standing in the world of research, and then, you know, obviously rankings performance follows from that. And one of the things that they think has been very good about the Excellence Initiative is the sort of research clusters, and I went to see one which is looking at Alzheimer's research. So I guess there's that argument that, you know, if your universities are more internationally prominent in research, then you get the best researchers in. You get more funding, you put it into things like developing Alzheimer's research, and you do better at it. But at some level, I imagine it is about, you know, about rankings performance in some way for at least some of the people involved in this.
Absolutely. Well, John's feature can be found on page 32 of our magazine, as well as the really interesting interviews he did. It's packed full of lots of data, so something for everyone, I would imagine. David, you've been learning about character education. First of all, what is that? How will it help students develop?
Right, so if you go through the pages of our sister magazine, Times Educational Supplement, TES, you'll find all kinds of articles about this, about character education. Mm. But it's not really made it into higher education. So what it is, it's all about trying to teach young people that their abilities are not limited, and then, you know, it's quite a hard thing to explain, but it's all about, you know, if you come across a problem, kind of being able to relish it being difficult and not thinking, oh, I'm no good at maths, but I'm good at English. Like all these ideas and all these abilities are kind of flexible, and it's also about teaching things like resilience. And proponents of character education say, actually, if your personality is, you know, highly resilient, you have lots of you keep coming back to a problem, you don't take setbacks badly, that is actually a better predictor of success in life than your academic performance. And so I was at a conference earlier this month, and people were talking about this. You're thinking, well, how can this be embedded in higher education? I'm sure academics will every time they're asked to embed something new in their teaching, they're going to probably a little shiver of horror. But they should be aware that this is potentially on the radar. And you know, the one of the guys, chief executive of the organisation PUSH, which is essentially a sort of research and university guide, a guy called Johnny Rich, was saying this is a way for students from more disadvantaged backgrounds to close the gap with their more advantaged peers by cultivating these kind of really deep personality advantages, basically. It goes without saying there's quite a few problems with all of this, which I to write a blog on. But I mean, I guess the big problem is how can this be taught? I mean, you're at university. You know, it's you're not there on the sort of psychologist's couch. You're that you do actually have to learn some content when you're at university. Yeah. So how on earth do you? How can lecturers actually at all alter what they teach students to improve the grit, as it were, of students? And the other big issue is, I don't know, it depends how you teach. Well, what kind of resilience, what are you teaching students? So when I spoke to Johnny Rich later on, he said, well, if students from poorer households go to a job interview and then they get turned down because they don't have the right accent or, you know, they're not the right background. Well, this gives them the drive to bounce back and you know, apply again and so on. And I just wonder whether you're teaching people at
Rudyard Kipling's If.
Yeah.
Well, it to me it sounds a bit like kind of teaching the, you know, the American Dream essentially, which is.
Prosperity is just around the corner.
Well, exactly, and you know, no matter what background you're from, you can do well. And I think the tension is, I mean, that's actually almost certainly good for you if you have that attitude. You are probably, I've no doubt you're more likely to succeed if you believe no matter where you're from, you can do well. But it's just not actually true. On aggregate, people are, you know, people's life chances are determined by their background. So, yeah, there's a lot of. Lots of thinking to be done, I think, before anyone is really taking this on as a core thing universities should be teaching. Well, and also people are 18 by the time they're by the time they get there, personalities are already
set. Yeah.
Well, they have a personality, yes, by the time they get. Whether they can change it is another question.
Quite. Well, I mean, as you mentioned, because it's so open and because it proposes quite difficult things to quantify and teach, I suppose, that does make it an interesting subject and something I'm sure that Mr. Rich and other proponents of it will probably have to answer in greater form in the future. David's piece is on page 15 of the magazine and is well worth a read if you have a thought on it. I expect you will want to voice it afterwards. Karen, books. Glorious books. Please fill us in what's going on.
This week's Shelf Life, our fortnightly feature, features Andre Carrington, who's an American academic who is interested in science fiction and the fact that it is overwhelmingly white. He is a professor of English and has an interest in black studies. So his book, Speculative Blackness, looks at, well, the whiteness of the future. Apparently there won't be many black people in that if you read most canonical science fiction. He looks at things as diverse as Ray Bradbury and Nichelle Nichols' memoir Beyond Uhura, she being the actor who played Uhura in Star Trek. He tells me what he's reading lately, including the graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg, Red Rosa, published by Verso, which is a fantastic book. Also this week, Richard Murphy, The Joy of Tax Man. I have to be carefully pause between tax and man. City University London academic takes on a book called Taxing the Rich, A History of Fiscal Fairness in the United States and Europe. He believes there is an argument implicit in this book, but not the one they say there is, these US academics. And Robert Eaglestone reviews a book by Lee Constantino called Cool Characters, Irony and American Fiction. The argument being made in this book, which is in a very acclaimed Harvard University Press series in literary studies, is that we are now in an age of post-irony. Robert considers where Donald Trump comes into that. Also this week, Marcus Chown is reviewing Richard Gott's book, The Cosmic Web, Mysterious Architecture of the Universe. And a debut review from Eve Worth from Queen's College, Oxford, who looks at a book called The PH Dictionary, a glossary of things you don't know but should about doctoral and faculty life. As you would expect from a dictionary, it runs from A to Z. However, what it really is a memoir of an academic, or a man who was an academic, who comes from a working class background and discovers how the cards are stacked against you. There are a lot of things in the dictionary that are germane to American doctoral study and not UK doctoral study, but Eve suggests there is also a lot to be learned, even for those of us in the UK. And this week's Book of the Week is by Rosalind Krauss, a very eminent art historian at Columbia University, who studied under Clement Greenberg. Interestingly enough, the book that is our Book of the Week, reviewed by Tracy Waugh, is about Willem de Koning, the famous Dutch-American painter, who is someone who was savaged by Clement Greenberg. Krauss obviously doesn't take the same view. And this book considers his seemingly endless series of paintings, quite terrifying paintings, the subject of which was woman. And she examines what he was trying to do. Apparently his view was that flesh was the reason oil painting was invented, and his impasto technique and scratching and so on was his way of exploring the use of the painting. He's also the person who famously, Robert Rauschenberg, asked for one of his paintings in order to erase it. And he allowed him to do so, and said, apparently, this book says that I'm not going to give you just any crappy old one. I'm going to give you a really good one, otherwise there would be no point. So Krauss makes a case for his importance, despite many others who argued that he was a bit of a dead end.
Including her mentor, did you say? Is that right?
Clement Greenberg, yeah.
Absolutely. And in terms of his importance, what does Krauss say about de Kooning? Because I know a little bit of working knowledge of de Kooning, but not loads, but he obviously was an important part of 20th century art, wasn't he?
Yes, certainly, but there were a lot of people who followed that, not only Greenberg, but also Harold Rosenberg, and artists who followed who dismissed him as kind of a dead end. So I suppose this would be Krauss's attempt to reclaim his reputation critically.
Absolutely.
And scaring us all with these pictures.
Right. Although they are very captivating, rather than scary, I would say. But
okay.
That's me. So Karen's book section starts on page 44. Fully worth checking out, especially the shelf life. I found that fascinating. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's Issue Review podcast. But as always, complete coverage of the latest HE news, features, and of course our books can be found in our magazine and on our website, timeshighereducation.com. We would love to hear from you, so if you have a comment to make about any of the issues discussed in this podcast or the week's content, please do so. We're on all manner of social media, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. You can also comment on our website, and you can also send letters to us. We read them all, and we don't discriminate. Please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Until next week's Issue Review Pod, however, I wish you goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.